The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. Good afternoon. Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Andy. I'm the program director here. As usual, before we start, if you could turn off your electronic devices, phones, toasters, hair dryers, things of that nature, we'll be in good shape. And also, if you could refrain from taking pictures during the talk, that would be great. As you know, Richard Clark has had a remarkable career in government, serving as a high-ranking official in the State Department or National Security Council in every administration since Ronald Reagan. His role, countering weapons of mass destruction and terrorism. Under President Clinton and Bush II, he was the chief of counterterrorism at the National Security Council. Moments after the attacks of September 11th began, National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice designated Mr. Clark as crisis manager in the White House Situation Room, from which he coordinated the government's emergency response. In the first chapter of his book, Against All Enemies, Clark gave a heart-stopping account of the turmoil inside the White House that morning. In his follow-up career as a novelist, he has produced two more books, and they are equally dramatic. Scorpion's Gate was a national bestseller about an evil, oil-grubbing U.S. Secretary of Defense and his Saudi pals whose sinister plan could plunge us into World War III. As Mr. Clark remarks at the end of his new novel, Breakpoint, sometimes you can tell more truth through fiction. Please welcome Richard Clark.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. It's great to be back at the Free Library, and thank you so much for taking time out of your day to come down and be part of this dialogue. I'm here to discuss my new novel, and that usually causes people to say, why are you writing novels? For those of you who are readers, novels are more fun to read. And for those of you who are writers, I suspect you already know novels are more fun to write than nonfiction. And what I've tried to do with Scorpion's Gate last year and with Breakpoint this year is to use the vehicle of the novel, particularly a thriller, to talk about interesting issues, important issues. In Scorpion's Gate, the important issues had to do with the Middle East and America's dependence on oil and America's lack of understanding of the Islamic world and America's arrogance in interacting with the Middle East. Some people thought when they read Scorpion's Gate that they were thinly veiled real people. Somebody thought that the nefarious Secretary of Defense was actually Donald Rumsfeld. In Breakpoint, this year, I do the same kind of thing of trying to project forward 5 years so that we can begin to think about what it will be like 5 years from now, what the issues will be, important issues will be 5 years from now, and do it again in the form of a thriller. 5 years is about all I can see out into the future. And I think it used to be that futurists would say, well, 20 years from now we're going to have this, or 50 years from now we're going to have this. Remember the World's Fair in New York in the 1930s that said, by 1950 all cars will fly. Well, when I look at this Google Expressway, I'm just glad that they don't. But it's difficult to project, I think, more than 5 years, in part because the rate of change, technological change, is accelerating. This was hard for me to figure out, but with the help of some people at MIT and Harvard, I actually looked at the technologies and realized the emerging technologies all feed on each other. So computer science advances made it possible to do the human DNA decoding. You couldn't have done the one without the other. And what we have now is a series of technologies in robotics, computer science, pharmacology, genetics, all of which are going faster and faster and faster in their breakthroughs. And they will change the nature of the society in which we live in the next 5 years. When people look back 50 or 100 years from now on this period, 2006, 2007, I think Iraq and the terrible American mistake in Iraq will get one or two lines in the history books. It'll be, you know, and during this period right after the turn of the century, the second President Bush made a terrible mistake in Iraq. But then the history books will go on to talk about the revolutionary society-changing things that were occurring in the laboratories in the United States and around the world during that period of 2006, 2007, and out through the next 5 to 10 years. Revolutionary things are occurring in laboratories. Only recently did we decode human DNA, and that has allowed us to understand so much more about who we are and how we work. In the next 5 to 10 years, it's going to go even faster. And this is going to cause some political problems, some sociological, societal problems. If you think about how bent out of shape some people are about abortion or a woman's right to choose, how some people really can't stand the fact that we're teaching evolution in the schools, and how the President of the United States doesn't want us doing stem cell research. If you think about that now, and then project out 5 to 10 years when we are going to be able to do genetic manipulation, what do you think those people are going to think then? What will the nature of our country be when we can manipulate genetics? The president appointed a committee to look into this, and they said, well, it's okay to manipulate genetics to fix things like Tay-Sachs or sickle cell, but it's not okay to play with genetics if it means enhancements. Well, enhancements, the reason they said that is enhancements are going to be possible. It is going to be possible to design a baby. It is going to be possible to take a pill which will improve your memory. I, for one, would really like that to exist now. And who is going to stop that technology? If the president and people like him try to stop it in the United States, it'll take place somewhere else. And the interesting question here is, if some people can take a pill and get smarter, if some people can design their baby and get a smarter baby, or a healthier one, or one that will live longer, and other people can't because it costs too much money, over time, that can change the nature of our country. You know, throughout history, the rich have always thought they were smarter. And throughout history, that's never been true. Bill Clinton used to love to tell the story that the great minds throughout history were usually poor kids. Now, he had someone in mind when he said that. But what if that ceases to be true in the future? What if in the future, just as today, only the rich can afford certain kinds of plastic surgery. Insurance plan won't pay for it. Government won't pay for it. What if in the future only the rich can afford the scientific advances that allow for smarter, healthier, more physically capable people? What if that goes on for a couple of generations and the rich actually are different and actually are smarter. How do we have a democracy? How do we have social equality? How do we have social stability in that kind of environment? You see where I'm going here. There are going to be real hot, intense debates 5 to 10 years from now that will make the debates about abortion, about the woman's right to choose, about stem cell research look like a walk in the park. And I think we need to start thinking about this stuff now. Because even today, now, we are really dependent upon technology that didn't exist a few years ago. When the Clinton administration started, there wasn't much of an internet. There was a little bit, but not much. And by the time the Clinton administration was over, this whole country depended upon the internet. I'm not thinking about emails or buying books at Amazon.com, although you can, if you wanted to buy a book. But the electric power system, the municipal water system, rail systems, air traffic control, health care, banking, the stock market, they all depend upon computer-controlled networks. And all of those computer-controlled networks can be attacked. They're all vulnerable. There was a hospital, major Harvard Research Hospital, teaching hospital in Boston a couple of years ago that had to close for several days and send all the patients elsewhere because the computer network crashed. Hospital couldn't work without the computer network. There was a major airline, Air Canada, which grounded all of its planes, canceled all of its flights one day within the last few years because its reservation computer system crashed. Now, the planes worked fine, but they couldn't figure out who should be on what plane and who had paid and who hadn't, and so they didn't fly. There are still some of us who believe that the major power failure that occurred 2 years ago in the Northeast had its origin in the failure of the computer networks that controlled the power grid. When I was in the White House, we got some teams in the government to try to hack their way in to the control systems for power grids to see if that was possible. If you could jump from the internet into the power grid controls and literally turn off the power grid. And the conclusion they came to was, yes, they can do that. So that's today. Today, people are stealing by the hundreds of millions credit card numbers and social security numbers in online hacking. Today, some foreign country is hacking its way into computer systems of the federal government and stealing huge, huge amounts of information. And the government doesn't know who it is and can't stop them. So we are already dependent upon cyberspace. If cyberspace stopped working today, the lights would probably go out. The traffic lights out there would certainly go out. Probably the control system for SEPTA, well, maybe not. But the ATM machines wouldn't work. The stock market would collapse. You know, it is a very frequent occurrence nowadays when a computer system for a major company crashes, they send everybody home. Because people can't do anything without cyberspace. Well, let's project forward into the future in Breakpoint. And there's a little tension developing between the United States and China. And maybe something is happening in cyberspace, and maybe it's the Chinese who are doing it. Well, in the real world, China has formed cyber armies. And a Chinese general has publicly stated in the real world that in the future, if there were tensions between the United States and China, China might reach out through cyberspace and turn off the American electrical power grids. So in Breakpoint, to look at these issues through the vehicle of a thriller, we have the book beginning with a series of explosions that take down part of the internet, destroy part of cyberspace. And then a whole series of other attacks occur that are aimed at biological engineering facilities and genetic engineering facilities. Somebody is attacking the leading edge technology in the United States. Is it China? Is it some sort of crazy Unabomber guy? Is it the right-wing people who are opposed to stem cell research and genetic engineering? Well, the FBI and Homeland Security and all the Keystone cops try to find out. But they're not too good at this stuff. So a small team of unconventional experts start to try to find out who did it. And our hero is an African, young African-American woman who leads the investigation and tries to find out who is stopping America's technological advance, who's blowing up cyberspace, who's turning off the country. Is it China? Is it somebody else? Before it's too late. Before terrible damage is done and we're thrown back into the 20th century. That's the plot of the book. I can't tell you too much more because there's a surprise ending. But I hope through the vehicle of the book to tell you something of what I've learned about these new technologies that are right around the corner. And after you've read the book, wait until after you've read the book and then read the author's note at the back. Because in the author's note at the back, I go through and tell you which of the science fiction things that are going on in the book are real. And give you a clue. They all are. And I walk through where these various technologies are now and when we expect them to come on the scene. I talk to a lot of scientists and engineers in trying to figure this out, sociologists. And a number of them said something to me that was just startling. They said, given our advances in genetic engineering and our understanding is now of the cellular process of aging and the biochemical process of aging, given the fact that we're now doing implants into the human body, you know, I suspect a lot of us are going to get implants in the next few years, whether it's a knee or a hip or something. But there are other implants that are being done now. People who are paralyzed are able to move artificial limbs by connecting their brain and their brain waves to the artificial limbs. That's not science fiction. That's happening today. And so given all of these advances, several scientists said to me, there are probably kids today, 3 years old, 4 years old in preschool, who will be alive when in this country the major source of people dying will not be aging. The major source of people dying will not be disease. The major source of people dying will be accidents and violence, because medical science, biological science, and engineering may make so many breakthroughs in the next 60 years, 70 years, in the life of people who are alive today, that death as we know it from medical causes may stop. And during the life of people who are alive today, the human species might take control of its own evolution, might be able to figure out steps with genetic engineering to improve the species, and might do it. No species has ever taken control of its own evolution before. And we may not see it, but the kids over in the preschool might. That's a very exciting concept. It's a very scary concept for some people. It'll have political implications. It'll have economic implications. But if it's true, and these are reputable people who believe this, if it's true that we are about to take control of evolution, We should start talking about it. So, it's a little departure for me from writing about terrorism and writing about the Middle East, although there's a fair amount of terrorism in Breakpoint as well. That's the book. I hope you get a chance to either take it out from the free library or buy it. And when you do, I'd love to hear your comments on it. In the time remaining, I know some of you may have questions about the president's brilliant plan in Iraq and other related issues, and I will be glad to try to field your questions. Thank you very much.
So I see a lot of familiar faces, so I know many of you know how this works. Those of you who don't, if you raise your hand, I'll try to get to as many questions as possible. Please leave your hand up and please wait for the microphone. Who'd like to start us off? Right in the center here. Lonnie, if you could wait for the mic, please. We'll get it to you.
Do you think, based on what you said, that we should have a new department in our government, sort of the Department of Cyberspace, and get the best minds there to, you know, be able to handle some of these situations? And the second part of the question is, have they asked you to write for 24 yet?
Let me answer the 24 part first. I have never seen 24. And no one understands why that's the case. And part of the reason is, and you'll see the connection in a minute, I carry a BlackBerry. Now, for those of you who don't have one of these things, don't get them. Because they are as addictive as cocaine or heroin or any other terrible thing. And now that I have this addiction, I don't need another one. And I've been told by all of my friends that if you start watching 24, you get addicted. So, no, I haven't seen it. And I can't tell you whether it's true or... I doubt it. But should there be a Department of Cyberspace? There ought to be a Department of Science and Technology. Most countries, first world countries, leading countries of the world, have a Department of Science and Technology. We don't. And, you know, the government, Al Gore was right about a number of things, and one of them was he did help to create the Internet. But the government did create the Internet. And then it ran away from it and turned it over to the private sector. And so much now of all of the advances in computer science are being done in the private sector, which is fine. Except that some of the basic research that we need to be done, private companies won't do anymore. You know, we used to have Bell Labs and all these great private sector labs, and now corporations really aren't putting a lot of money into advanced research because it's all about the bottom line, and it's all about quarterly profits and keeping the stock price up, and therefore they don't put money into really long-term research. And so the private sector is not doing a lot of research in cyberspace, and the government's not doing a lot of research in cyberspace. And that's one of the reasons that we continue to have hacking, because we're still using the same old techniques of writing computer code that were invented 30 years ago.
Another question right here in front.
I'm very vague about the present regime's concept of victory or success in Iraq. Can you give me a detailed explanation of what that would consist of?
Well, you know, about a year ago, the administration was taking a lot of criticism for not having a strategy. And so they got a professor from North Carolina, I think, to come up to the White House and spend some time there. And he wrote something that they called a strategy for victory. And I was really looking forward to it. because I wanted to know the same thing that you want to know, which is what's the strategy and what do they think victory is? And it came out, and you can still go to the WhiteHouse.gov website and find it and download it, Strategy for Victory. I passed it around to my students, because I teach occasionally at Harvard at the Kennedy School, and asked them to critique it. And pretty much everybody had the same reaction, which is, if we turned this paper into you, you'd give us an F. There wasn't really a strategy there. And they didn't really define victory. I don't ever want to be quoted as saying that I don't want victory. But sometimes victory and defeat aren't apt words. They're not appropriate words to describe. Well, you know, if you're having a problem with your spouse, do you want to really say, I had victory and they didn't? There are relationships, there are problems in life where victory and defeat may not be the way of looking at the problem. The problem we've got in Iraq right now, I think, is twofold. One, we're there. We're an occupying army. And most Iraqis don't like that. And therefore, some Iraqis are attacking us because we're there. That's one problem. The other problem we have is that we eliminated the police state that had kept them from fighting each other. And now they're fighting each other based on religious and ethnic divisions. We can't help them on that. We really can't be the ones who take the Kurds and the Sunnis and the Shia or the groups within Shia Islam and get them together. They're going to have to do that themselves. So the presence of U.S. troops is in part the reason there's fighting, and the other fighting that's going on among the factions is not being helped by the presence of U.S. troops. And we're sort of caught in the crossfire there. So when you ask yourself, why do we need 120,000 troops there, or now 150, whatever we're going to build it, none of the reasons that the president and his people give justifies having troops there, at least in my mind. They say, well, if we leave, there'll be chaos. There's chaos already. If we leave, Al-Qaeda will use it as a training ground. Al-Qaeda is using it as a training ground against us. And in fact, if your concern is Al-Qaeda using it as a training ground, you don't need 150,000 troops there. You can use intelligence operations, special forces, airstrikes. You can use regional countries. And there are lots of ways of going after terrorists that have proved very successful around the world that don't require 150,000 U.S. troops there. So if I try to give them an argument that makes sense, they say, well, if we leave now, the chaos will be worse than if we leave 3 or 5 years from now. That may be right. May be right. There's no way of knowing, but it may be right. But what that really says is there's some level of chaos that's going to occur, and if we stay longer, that chaos will be slightly less. And we don't know how to measure that. But because of that difference in chaos, if we leave now versus leaving later, we should stay. So in order to have the chaos be a little bit less, we're going to have more Americans killed? We've had more Americans killed there than died in the World Trade Center and Pentagon attacks. Beyond the ones who've been killed, we've had many, many more wounded. You know, we have 2,000 double amputees, 35,000 Iraqis dead in the last year alone in fighting, $400 or $500 billion spent down a rat hole that didn't do any good for anybody, didn't build anything. And if we stay longer, all of that's going to happen again. So that we can have a little difference in chaos when we leave. It does not make any sense to me. And I know in Washington you're supposed to be reasonable and you're supposed to, you know, say that your opponent is a worthy person who, you know, has some good arguments. But I just don't see any reason in the world that we don't start getting out now. And when we do withdraw all of our combat forces over the course of a year or so, as Baker and Hamilton recommended, we can still have a role there with intelligence, with special forces, with our aid missions and whatnot. We're not going to walk away. We're not going to cut and run if we pull our combat troops out. But having our combat troops there doesn't do anybody any good. It's my theory.
Right here in the second row.
Yes. I know that Rice's expertise was, what, Russia and the Cold War? Is there anyone in the administration that has any knowledge at all about this culture, which is, what, older than our country? Is there anybody there that can tell them that you cannot change what's there into what's here the way they want to do it? Is there anyone inside the administration?
It's a great question, because if you look at the expertise of the people who sat around the table and decided to do this, you're right. Condi Rice, very good expert on the Soviet Union and the Warsaw Pact, neither of which exist anymore. Steve Hadley, the man who replaced her as National Security Advisor, great expert on arms control with the Soviet Union and the Warsaw Pact, neither of which exist anymore. The guy they put in charge of Iraq, Paul Bremer, had worked in the Foreign Service. He was ambassador to Holland. No. I mean, the answer is that the people who really were at the core of this decision-making process to invade Iraq had never been to Iraq or the Middle East and spent much time there, with one exception. My friend Donald Rumsfeld had actually gone to Iraq a few times to meet with Saddam Hussein. So I think your point is absolutely right, that there was not a lot of understanding about the culture, about the history. There's a reporter in Washington who, as a joke, goes around and interviews people and asks one question consistently. And he just asked this question to the new Democrat chairman of the Intelligence Committee in the House. And the question is, what's the difference between Shia and Sunni? Well, no one, you know, that this guy has asked that question to can answer it, which is kind of tragic when you realize that we have 120,000 troops in the middle of a civil war between the Shia and the Sunni. So it does help to actually understand the culture and the history of a place before you invade it.
Gentleman with his finger in the air about three quarters of the way back on your left, Kim. If you could wait for the mic, sir. Could you put your hand up? Thanks.
Could you, as a follow-up to the question just asked, could you comment on the role that Professor Bernard Lewis played or didn't play in that, which...
Well, Professor Bernard Lewis at Princeton University is an expert on the Middle East and has written several interesting books. He was brought in by the number two guy in the Pentagon at the time, Paul Wolfowitz, to do a tutorial for some of the people in the administration on the Middle East. I don't think that's enough. I think it's kind of too late at that point when you already decided to invade a country. Let's get a professor in to tell us something about the country. You know, they also say, people say a lot, that the president doesn't read, which is what I was told in the first month of the administration. Don't give him a lot to read. He's not a reader. But now they're saying, oh, no, that's not true. He reads a lot. And you may have seen over the course of the summer, he said he read a lot of Shakespeare's. And I haven't done that. I've only read one. But they're now saying that he's reading books about the Middle East, and specifically that he's currently working his way through a book about Algeria and the insurgency in Algeria. And that sounded encouraging until I realized further down in the news story that the person who's now giving him his books to read is Henry Kissinger.
Immediately to your left, Kim, gentleman right there.
Given the history of this administration of rewarding its friends and punishing its enemies, have you had any personal incidents of either?
Well, I expected that there would be some retribution. And the first week, Against All Enemies came out, and I testified before the 9/11 Commission and went on 60 Minutes. The administration kind of got caught flat-footed, didn't see it coming, and tried to scramble in the first week to say something bad about me. And they came up with all sorts of things to say bad about me, and they kind of contradicted each other. Cheney said I wasn't in the loop. Rice said I was in the loop. The Washington Post said I was the loop. There were a number, now that I'm in the private sector and have to earn a living by consulting, there were a number of companies that I was either consulting with or planning to consult with that wouldn't think of doing it because of the White House's attitude toward me. But the interesting thing is during the course of that first week when they were releasing all of my emails and doing all sorts of things, at about Friday afternoon of that week or Saturday, you could see it happen. They stopped. And the order clearly went out to stop attacking. And I could feel it being implemented. The attacks had stopped, but I didn't quite realize what had happened. And then I still know people in the White House, and so I found out later why they had given the order to everybody to stop attacking me, and that was they realized, somewhat belatedly, that they were selling my book.
Folks, I'd ask you to be patient. We'll try to get to as many of you as we can, all the way in the back there.
Hi. Thank you for speaking. And I sort of want to take it back to the first question about the Internet. Mm-hmm. And you said, I want to know your reasons why you think, what are the positives of giving the Internet over to the private sector to run, and what are the drawbacks? And maybe you could talk about the private sector and the war in Iraq.
Well, the Internet has to be run by the private sector. It has to be run by telephone companies and Internet providers, and companies need to own their own networks. But I do think there's a role for the government in two or three respects. One is funding basic research, which the private sector won't do anymore. And two is in regulation. Now, regulation's a dirty word in Washington for some people. But regulation means that our food that we buy is healthy. We have regulations about food. We have regulations about drugs. Regulations keep us alive in many respects. We have not regulated the Internet very much. And I think we need to think about, if you're going to have my Social Security number, my credit card numbers, if you're going to have my health files on your computer system, you damn well ought to have it secure. And so hackers can't go in and steal it. Japan passed a law saying if you have more than 5,000 people's privacy information, social security numbers, credit card numbers, health information, if you have more than 5,000 persons' information on your network, then you have to follow these rules to secure it. and make sure it's protected. I think the government could do that. I think the government could say, if you're going to run the electric power grid and you're a private company, you ought to have some security on that electric power grid so hackers can't get in and turn it off. So I think the government can also do that kind of regulation. The private sector in Iraq is an interesting issue because we really don't just have 140,000 U.S. people in Iraq. The number is much bigger because it's all sorts of people doing military jobs, running around with guns, who are private contractors from companies like Triple Canopy and Blackwater and my personal favorite, Halliburton. And when reporters have tried to find out how many of these guys are there, the Pentagon says it doesn't know, which stretches credulity, I think. But the private sector role in Iraq, I think, is disturbing in that it hides the true size of our presence there, number one. Number two, because these companies are getting paid a lot of money, much more than they would be paid for doing anything anywhere else. Now, true, it's dangerous, and therefore danger pay comes into account. But many of the companies are getting paid a lot of money and not delivering anything. You know, they're paid to build a school or build a hospital or repair a refinery, and they don't in some cases. The Congress created something called the Special Inspector General for Iraq to hunt out these cases of fraud by U.S. private companies in Iraq. And the administration responded by trying to terminate the office of the Special Inspector General. Congress went back and put it back in. So there are now all sorts of draft reports from the Special Inspector General, and you're about to see them come out. Now that Henry Waxman is in charge of the government committee, Government Investigations Committee in the House, he's going to hold a series of hearings and have these reports issued. And we're going to see how billions of dollars have gone to these private contractors who really haven't done much in many cases to deserve being paid. I wouldn't pay a contractor working on my house for not working on my house or for a project that didn't get completed. But apparently the Pentagon's been doing this. And one thing about Henry Waxman, who you will probably get to see a lot in the press, is he's not, if you've done something wrong, he is not the guy you want investigating. He's really good. And it's going to be a very interesting series of hearings coming up.
Time for a couple of more questions, and I see more hands than we're going to be able to get to. The lady in the red shirt and the black scarf right here.
Yes, I was curious about your thoughts regarding Senator Biden's idea. There was no Iraq before Winston Churchill created it in 1921, and why we couldn't redeploy our troops around the oil wells and have an international group from neighboring countries, both Shia and Sunni, augmenting and stimulating where and to whom the revenues would go.
Senator Biden and Les Gelb, former president of the Council on Foreign Relations, have this proposal that we let Iraq divide itself up into three states, Shia, Sunni, and Kurds. If they want to do that themselves, if that is an Iraqi idea, then I think, you know, we should talk with them about it, and at the end of the day, they're going to have to make that decision by themselves. But it's not, at the moment, an Iraqi idea. In part, I think, because it's not clear where you draw the line. And in drawing the line, you might cause a real problem. To draw the line between Kurdistan in the north and whatever stand it would be in the south, you have to draw it through where a lot of the oil is. And what oil would be on my side, what oil would be on your side, tough issue. In Baghdad itself, I mean, you've got Sunnis in one part of the country, Shia in another part of the country, Kurds in another part of the country, but in Baghdad itself, you've got all three, largely Shia and Sunni. Neighborhoods used to be mixed, and that's less and less the case now. But it would still be difficult to divide up Baghdad. Also, many of the countries in the region do not want three little Iraqs. The Turks, for example, do not want an independent Kurdistan. And while it might be the solution to the Iraq problem to divide it up, it would create another problem because, frankly, Turkey would probably go to war to prevent an independent Kurdistan. They've said they would. Having spent some time with the Turkish army, I think they actually would. So what is probably better than letting it become three countries is letting it develop a federation where there are three or four semi-autonomous areas where the Kurds can run their own state within the country. And there's a guarantee that all of the states get a fair share of the oil revenue based on the number of people living in the state. I think that's where they're going. But again, it's for the Iraqis to do this, not for us.
If you can keep coming down right here, the lady with her hand up again in red.
Looking at the buildup, we're probably going to have about 150,000 troops, I think, in Iraq. Are we being set up for an incident that we will then have a staging ground to go into Iran?
Question is all of this buildup really just to get us ready to turn right and go into Iran? You know, I would have said 3 or 4 months ago that I don't think even this administration is so stupid as to think it could invade Iran. That you would hope that they kind of learned their lesson by invading a country that was one-third the size of Iran. But I think there's some troubling signs. The president has sent another aircraft carrier battle group to set off the coast of Iran. He's sending Patriot missiles into the region. There are articles appearing in the press overseas about plans the United States is making to attack Iran. Now, we don't know whether it may be that the administration is actually smart and is playing mind games with the Iranians to get them to back down from their nuclear program. But the problem with mind games and bluffs is that sometimes people call your bluff. And I just think war with Iran would be unbelievably disastrous because they're bigger and stronger than Iraq. They have terrorists that are better than al-Qaeda. They have probably the ability to strike terrorism in the United States. They could probably shut off all of the oil coming out of the Persian Gulf, which is, I think, about probably more than a third of the world's oil. If you're going to do something like bomb the Iranian nuclear facilities, which might make you feel good for a few minutes, you got to figure out what's the next step, what do they do in response, and then what do you do in response to their response, and where does it all end up? You got to think through the whole scenario and then say, this is the way it could end up. And is that better than where we are today? And every time I've done that and done it with experts in the Middle East and the military and in Iran, the answer's always been you're worse off after. When all of the retaliation, counter-retaliation with Iran is over, you're worse off than when you began. And I know there are military people who know that. And the new Secretary of Defense, Robert Gates, is quoted in the New York Times today as suggesting he doesn't think it's a good idea. So let's keep our fingers crossed.
Got time for one more question. Gentleman here with the glasses. Keep your hand up, sir. Stop. Gentleman to your right. Jamie, you're right. Yeah, fellow you're talking to. Oh, sorry.
Why did we go to war with Iraq?
There's no one reason. In the book Against All Enemies, I think I tick off about five or six reasons. And, you know, there's some obvious ones before I give you my real theory. You know, obviously WMD, which there wasn't any. Obviously the connection between Al-Qaeda and Iraq, which there wasn't any. I think it's a lot simpler than people are really working hard, historians and analysts trying to figure this out. And for Cheney and for Wolfowitz and for Rumsfeld and everybody, there's probably a different combination of reasons with every one of those guys. Some people, it might have been about the oil. Some people really might have thought that we could plant democracy. And I think for George Bush, the overriding reason was probably something like this. And I'm going to oversimplify, and I know I'm oversimplifying, but stay with me. Let's say you're a little boy and you go to school in a new neighborhood. And the first week you're in school, you go out in the recess yard, and some kid, hits you down to the ground, bloodies you. And you go home and you're all bloodied. And you think, you know, I have to go to that school for many, many years. And if everybody thinks I'm a wimp that you can push around, I'm going to be in trouble. So instead, I'm going to go back to that schoolyard tomorrow, and I'm going to find the biggest, meanest kid. And when he's not looking, I'm going to floor him. And then everybody will know I'm a tough guy and you can't push me around. For George Bush, he came into office 9 months after he came into office, while he was still, you know, finding his way. The worst attack on the United States occurred since World War II. And I heard him say, we have to do something to prove that we're not an easy target, and that there's a price to pay for attacking us. We thought the right answer to that requirement was to go into Afghanistan, which is where Al-Qaeda was, and after all, it was Al-Qaeda that attacked us. But beginning that night, beginning on the night of 9/11, in the White House, Rumsfeld and others were saying, and this is a direct quote from Rumsfeld, there's not enough to bomb in Afghanistan. In other words, if we're really going to prove we are the junkyard dog, the mean guy that you don't mess with, we really have to take on somebody big. And Afghanistan's just not big enough. So let's look around the Middle East and find the meanest guy, the biggest Arab army, the one who's got the toughest reputation, and let's knock him off. Even if he has nothing to do with what just happened. Because he's a bad guy anyway, and because we want a demonstration effect. We want to achieve deterrence, deter other people from ever attacking us again by demonstrating how mean and tough and capable we are. And so you invade Iraq, and in 20 days, the war is over. You've defeated their army ran away, you occupied their country, and the mean, tough dictator is hiding in some rat hole somewhere. That I really think is the overriding reason Bush did it. And perversely, it has had the opposite effect. Because we have demonstrated to the world the limits of American military power. If we could just have done the 20 days, destroy their army, occupy their capital, find Saddam and Uday and Qusay and get out, that would have been impressive. And it might have deterred somebody, I don't know. But that wasn't the plan. The plan was to go in and then, you know, try to turn this place that had been a dictatorship throughout 5,000 years into sort of like, you know, the Montgomery County League of Women Voters Club or something. Not a well thought out plan, not done by somebody who understands the region, but I do think that was the overriding theory behind invading Iraq.
Folks, thank be you. Careful on the playground. Richard Clark.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's author event series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.